then.
So last week we talked about the Heart Sutra, and I had on the schedule to continue talking about the Heart Sutra because Okamura's chapter on it is so long and has wonderful stuff in it. But I felt like expanding the conversation a little bit, and not talking about the Heart Sutra specifically, but about the Prajnaparamita Sutras and another example of it. So, Tyler previously put a link in the chat, but I guess you can do that already. You can pull up the text that we will be looking at tonight, and y'all can pass that out. If you need another copy, I have one more here that I don't technically need. On the website, on the Tuesday study page, you can either pull up, like there's a website that has this text on it. Alternately, you can pull up a PDF of it. You can print out that PDF. I also put on that page a link where you can download a Microsoft Word document, which makes a booklet, which is what I made for the Dirt Zendo. I just thought it'd be sweet to have a little booklet of this, these beautiful verses. So is everybody in the cloud? Anybody not able to access this? I see some of you sitting outside. You're probably using your phone. Okay, so on the Tuesday study webpage, under today, it's under July 1st. It says the first two chapters of the verses on the perfection of wisdom, the Prajnaparamita, Ratna Guna Samkhyagata. So then there's several links. So, yeah. So I will explain a little bit. And if you are not, if you're sitting out on your porch and you don't really have a good way of pulling this up, I will be reading parts of it out loud and then we'll talk about it. I just think it is nice to have it in front of you. So the Heart Sutra, that we chant, is part of a larger body of works and that are called the Prajnaparamita Sutras. Prajna is wisdom and Paramita is perfection. So the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Now, all of these date back to, nobody knows who wrote them. Like there's no author that sat down and wrote them. I mean, obviously somebody wrote something, but they, it's that kind of unknown authorship and things evolve. So these started developing about 100 BC, so only about 400 years after the Buddha died. And then there's just all different kinds of versions. So there's the Prajnaparamita, or Perfection of Wisdom, in 8,000 lines, which is kind of a prose work. Our two little chapters here are from a poetic verse version of that, which kind of is its own thing, I guess. It's the Ratna Guna. There's the Heart Sutra is considered, that's the shortest, right? It's called the Heart because it's encapsulates the Prajnaparamita teachings, the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, in just such a tiny little text. But there's also the Perfection of Wisdom in 25,000 lines, 10,000 lines. There's like other short pieces, and they're all kind of lumped together as this kind of family of texts, because they borrow from one another, they have repeated themes, they have repeated teachings, and they really focus on the teaching of emptiness. So you can get the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines and its verse summary translated by Edward Kanza. And that's what this translation is from. I don't think there's any other translations of 8,000 Lines out there. There should be someday, because he did this many years ago. I think 1973. But he says in the intro that these first two chapters of this verse section, which has, I guess I should say how many chapters it has. The verse version has, see, it's in Roman numerals here, 31. So there's 31 chapters. These are the first two. And Kanza said, in my view, the 41 verses of the first two chapters constitute the original Prajnaparamita, which may well go back to 100 BC, and of which all the others are elaborations. So, as I say in my little intro there, regardless of that, I think and hope that you will agree that these two chapters are just, they're just beautiful and stand on their own. So I figured we would just go through it line by line, and I'd stop every once in a while and talk about it. And if you have any questions or thoughts, you can jump in. So let's see. Thereupon the Lord, the Buddha has many epithets, which we will, he's called the Jina. I put in a footnote. Victor or conqueror, the Tathagata, one who is truly gone, well gone one. Thereupon the Lord, in order to gladden the four assemblies, that is male monks, female monks, lay women, lay men, and to further lighten up this perfection of wisdom, preached at that time the following verses. And then the first, the preliminary admonition and the source of Subhuti's authority are just kind of flowery praises of this teaching in and of itself. So we can kind of skip that. Most of these scriptures will have that. They'll have just a, I don't know if you ever looked at the Lotus Sutra, but the Lotus Sutra talks about how incredibly important the Lotus Sutra is. And it keeps on talking about how incredibly, and you should honor it and be amazed to be hearing it. And it's the Lotus Sutra is the most amazing thing. And then you're kind of like, what? Where is it? When are we going to get to it? It's kind of strange. I can't say that I've ever really been like, oh, there it is. But I feel like in this case, we do get to, though. We get to some meat. So under the basic teachings, no wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, no thought of enlightenment either. So this is, you know, just like the Heart Sutra, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no four noble truths, nothing. But I like this, no wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva. None of this is anything we can get hold of. When told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the well-gone's wisdom. So the very fact that they would say that this, you know, if you are a bodhisattva is coursing well, you are practicing the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, really well, if you are not bewildered or made anxious by the prospect of emptiness. The very fact that you say that means, well, it's kind of natural that we get a little bewildered and made anxious by emptiness, by the kind of the sense that there's nothing we can really hold on to. And in a way, we will lose everything. And it's quite existentially unnerving if you really look at it. We don't always feel existentially anxious when our life is going well. There's lots of things to enjoy. But basically, the four messengers of old age, disease, and death remind us that, you know, we can't hold on to anything. But when we are not bewildered and in no way anxious, even though we face that impermanence and ungraspable nature of things head on. So it's not just about being not bewildered and in no way anxious because we're ignoring it, right? We're just trying not to think about it. It's like when we really face it, we're not bewildered and not anxious. So in form, in feeling, will, perception, and awareness, nowhere in them they find a place to rest on. So these are the five skandhas or aggregates that we are said to compose a being, right? Our form, our body, feeling, will, perception, and awareness. Nowhere in them do we find a place to rest. Without a home, bodhisattvas wander. Dharmas never hold them. So dharmas is low dharma D, things. Things never hold or limit them, nor do they grasp at them. The jinas, the Buddha's bodhi or enlightenment, they are bound to gain. The wanderer Srenika, in his gnosis of the truth, deep spiritual insight into the truth, could find no basis, though the skandhas had not been undone. So even though Srenika was not a Buddhist, so he wasn't like an enlightened Buddhist, but he was a deep spiritual seeker. So even he saw that the skandhas had no basis. Just so the bodhisattva, when he comprehends the dharmas as he should, does not retire into blessed rest. In wisdom, then he dwells. So he does not, the bodhisattva does not go off into nirvana and isolation, but remains engaged in the world for the sake of others. What is this wisdom? Whose and whence, he queries. And then he finds that all these dharmas are entirely empty. Uncowed and fearless in the face of that discovery, not far from Bodhi is that Bodhi being then. To course in the skandhas, in form, in feeling, in perception, will, and so on, and fail to consider them wisely, or to imagine these skandhas as being empty, means to course in the sign, the track of non-production ignored. So this is a pointing toward radical non-duality. So the Prajnaparamita teachings are always trying to pull the rug out from under you. So we can have this sense of the skandhas. Okay, the skandhas are empty. There's nothing you can grasp within them. They're impermanent. There's nothing, no unchanging essence within them. So that's imagining them as empty. And this is saying that is also not the perfection of wisdom. Same as like thinking there's something real. So you might think of something, there's something real. That's not it. If you think of them as empty, that's not it. So what? I mean, here we are. We've just been talking about things as being empty. So this is really subtle, and it's something we can describe intellectually, but we should really emphasize this is not about some kind of intellectual philosophical thing, because I mean, what's the point of that? This is pointing towards something that we can experience. This is a way of being in the world. This is a way of functioning as a sentient being. So it's pointing us toward this way of being. So when we imagine the skandhas as being empty, there is a way that we can be thinking of them as something that is real, that is empty. You know what I mean? It's like we're still creating a mental concept of the skandhas. We're just saying they can't be grasped. They're impermanent. They're, and yet we are still, want to say, yeah, we're still imagining as if they exist. We're just ascribing them a different quality. Now, non-production, so the track of non-production, which is what repeatedly the Bodhisattva is supposed to do, is non-production of any duality, any concept. So as I look around, I don't see people going, get it. All right. Yeah, please.
So about emptiness here. So I feel like there's a couple of different ways that emptiness is used. One way that it seems to be used here is emptiness as opposed to, so empty of self-nature,
mm-hmm.
in opposition to positing that there is self-nature. So it's just a reaction.
Yeah.
And yet also,
can use it, those of you online here, you're Dan, okay, would you, yeah, come sit over here.
Sorry, Cloud. So just talking about emptiness here, I feel like there's two different ways that we talk about it. One way is emptiness as opposed to, so empty of self nature, and that stands in opposition or reaction to, you know, imagining that there something has self nature.
Mm-hmm.
But then also we see it used, I think, sometimes in a little bit different context that's just a little bit different from that. And that's empty in a way that isn't in opposition to having self nature.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case, or am I making that up? In other words, emptiness in the sense of kind of radical possibility and sort of fullness that isn't describable by language.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I'm just like plumbing my brain here to think about, you know, because the, like I'm fond of saying, right? Reality with a capital R, we have lots of different ways to describe it. And I tend to think of when we use the word empty, that we are using it to say empty of what? That thing you think is there, right? So I tend to connect it with that. And yet, I think that Prajnaparamita literature and teachings are pointing us beyond that, right? So then what? So I'm just kind of looking for, like, so in what way?
But here in this context, maybe it just means empty of self nature.
I think, yeah, I mean, when we say empty, it's pointing toward what it's empty of, but that greater possibility that you're talking about, I think in a way this is what all of this is pointing toward, you know, the track of non-production, And the coursing in the perfection of wisdom. So it's almost like, so in a way, the perfection of wisdom, you might say, is bigger than just emptiness. It's like, it's another way to describe reality with a capital R, right? Unto itself. All right. Well, should we go on? Feel free to stop. Anybody has I thought
to question? Yes.
Yeah.
And I've lost track actually of where we are, but I have a question about what this really just if you could just say it to me in other words. Then you go through these four lines that sort of repeat what they just said, but when he does not force a form and feeling and perception or whatever, then the best of all the calming trances cleaves to him. Can you talk a little bit about
that? Okay, so we hadn't gotten to that one yet.
Oh, sorry.
All right, so when...
I loved it.
I should have... I mean, part of me wanted to go through, I just did this afternoon, part of me wanted to go through and change half of the he's to she's and all that kind of stuff, but whatever. When she does not course in form, in feeling or perception, in will or consciousness, but wanders without home, and remaining unaware of coursing firm in wisdom. So also not, you know. I am coursing in perfect wisdom.
Perfect. Normal sentences.
I think it's beautiful as poetry. Her thoughts on non-production, then the best of all the calming trances cleaves to her. I just love the wandering without a home. Right? Because when we think, all right, well, if I'm not going to operate based on some belief in the inherent reality of my body and sensation and perception and feeling and making some kind of person here who is inherently existing, if I don't do that, then what? You know, am I a zombie? Am I mindless? Am I like, what else is there? But the wandering without a home, it's like you, it's not that you then grab some other kind of understanding, some other way to, you know, conceptualize the world. You don't need that. And you don't have to be self-conscious of coursing firm in wisdom. And his thoughts on non-production, I would put that in terms of if you are practicing this non-production. And I'm really, you know, this way of talking about some kind of ideal bodhisattva who just does all this stuff perfectly is just a manner of speaking. I don't even think that we have to really believe that anyone has ever done this perfectly, right? Been some kind of amazing transcendent being, maybe. But it's pointing us toward an ideal. Like if we were to talk about, you know, how does a loving person act? A loving person acts like this. Like we could all talk about, if you are truly loving, this is what you would do. This is what you wouldn't do. So this is like, if you are truly a bodhisattva practicing in this realm of perfect wisdom, this is what you would do. So the best of all calming trances cleaves to him, I guess. I'm not thinking trance as in zomboidal trance, but just there's just an ease.
Right. It's feeling to me when we went through those four lines again, it's feeling to me like I can't imagine putting it into words any other way than this, although I don't think or talk like this, but it's almost like it's describing the most perfect, liberating way to abide. Mm-hmm. It's describing a sense of freedom to me that almost levitates you. It's so light.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I'm thinking.
Like that.
Maybe that's where they get, the yogis get levitation.
Clark?
Well, it seems that to me, it's describing Zazen, right? Like, mm-hmm. can't you wander without a home while you're sitting still? And that one of the exact words.
And people should get in the habit of coming up here.
Calming trances cleaves to him. I mean, isn't that essentially a description of
the Dharma Gate of Joyful Ease?
Thank you. The Dharma Gate of Joyful Ease. to me, those four lines are, that's exactly what it's describing. And something that has definitely been on my mind since Zazen Kai is just the idea that sitting in Zazen and being in that state of joyful ease is practice. The realization that if you can be in that state while doing nothing, well, then can't you be in that state doing anything that you come across? That's the one that's been like mm-hmm. turning in my head. I'm like, well, can't I be in a state of joyful ease while I'm like mopping the floor or while I'm playing pool or when I'm riding the bus here? You know what I mean? Instead of being like, it's just like, yep, this is my life. And, you know, it's okay. And it's good. You know, it's cool. Help people when you can. Thank you.
So through that, the Bodhisattva now dwells tranquil in himself. His future Buddhahood assured by antecedent Buddhas. Whether absorbed in trance or whether outside it, he minds not. For of things as they are, he knows the essential original name. Did you look at the next?
I did. Well, I did read the entire thing at first, but then it wasn't on my mind.
I just, speaking of that. And I just, like, when I read that, I feel so reassured, right? Because you can begin practice and there's some ways in which, of course, that it's great and it helps your life and you and everything. But then as you become aware of how your mind can be, of what it is like to be calm and settled and centered and whatever, you also become very aware of not being like that, right? Of all the getting caught up in the dream of thought and the, you know, the emotions and the drama and then this and that. So you become more conscious of that in a way than you were before. So it can feel, you know, for me anyway, it felt very a lot of tension or maybe self-judgment or something being outside, you know, whether absorbed in this or outside it. And yet it's like at a bigger level, this the bodhisattva minds not. Right. And for me, that's like when we are worried about whether we are absorbed in trance or we are outside it, we are concerned about we. We are caught up in the, we're just making more drama. When we just, you know, all of this is like, this only happens, this practice only happens, you know, this moment and this moment and this moment. So that's why my instructions for Zazen say, when you wake up from the dream of thought, be grateful and throw away past and future. Coursing thus, he courses in the wisdom of the Sugatas, another word for Buddhas or great realized beings. And yet he does not apprehend the dharmas in which he courses. This coursing she wisely knows as a no coursing. That is her practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. This is like a... I mean, we have to... In a way, we have to conceptualize and hear the teachings and whatever. That's a stage of our relationship to this. But ultimately, it is just a way of being. It's just a completely natural way of being that has no words attached to it at all. So when we do start to think, you know, am I being mindful or, you know, whatever, in a way, we're already not doing this. But I mean that.
But it helps us to get there, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, how else do you do it, right? Like you have to consciously, somebody has to tell you, well, here's a practice you could do. And you, oh, okay, let me try that. And then you do it, like, am I doing this right? And we struggle at it, and sometimes we are and we aren't. So that's just part of it. And yet, in a way, I think of it as kind of similar to like other complex activities, you know, like driving, right? That initially it's very awkward. You have to learn all kinds of stuff and you have to be really self-conscious of it. And then eventually it's just a natural thing that you do. And it's, your reactions are natural. As long as you're kind of paying attention, it just happens. What exists not, that non-existent the foolish imagine. Non-existence as well as existence they fashion. As dharmic facts, existence and non-existence are both not real. A bodhisattva goes forth when he wisely knows this.
Like judo.
I mean, we can make non-existence into, in a way, an existent thing. I mean, let's say if we're really, really concerned about ourselves, right? Having a kind of an existential crisis, and somebody, you know, talks very convincingly to us about like emptiness, and there's no one here. I mean, you could be very like upset that this non-existent person doesn't exist, right? Like we're thinking of a person, we're thinking of non-existence, and they're both just ideas. The sense in which things are empty or boundaryless means like existence and non-existence are both just two sides of a duality that doesn't apply. Exist, the way that we conceptualize of exist has boundaries around it in terms of time or space, right? There's this that exists. Oh, it doesn't exist anymore. So we have, it's just inherent in that very concept is boundaries. And yes, at the relative level, there are apparent boundaries, and it's useful for us to function as if my body isn't your body. My house isn't your house, right? But ultimately, in the realm of reality, all of those are just arbitrary distinctions that we project on with our minds. Rinat.
I wonder if there's...
Can you come up to the chair? Sorry.
I wonder if the perspective about that change, if you believe in reincarnation and souls. I know that you're not. But I feel like, because I think And I'm reading a book about reincarnation and in between life and souls, and I really believe in that. And I think that it might, the perspective about all of that change, because the emptiness is the ability to be connected to your soul and not being cut up in, you know, the body, the existence, the thought, and all that. So
I guess it depends on what you mean by soul, right? Because soul is an existent thing, like that can be, here it is, it's a little capsule, then contrary to the Buddhist teachings.
To all of them?
Yes.
Oh.
I mean, because Tibetans talk a lot about rebirth, but when you delve into it, they find a way, and this is perhaps the closest to reality, right? They find a way to talk about and teach and, you know, believe in rebirth and emptiness. And it's like, I don't know how to describe. I mean, my imagination of it is, so this is how the mythology goes. And I don't necessarily believe in it, but I think it might point towards something real, which is like, in a way, whatever we are would just dissipate. Except that if we have unresolved shit, we're drawn back to come back. Like, I felt really lonely this lifetime. So then the next time I'm seeking for human connection or something, right? So something brings me back, or somebody hurt me and I'm angry and bitter and I want to come back for revenge or something like that, right? Some unresolved thing drives us to rebirth.
Yeah.
But if you are enlightened, if you are awakened, like you kind of have the option of dissipating, but you choose to come back. So I don't know. There's some, maybe after death, some aspect of choice remains.
All right. Yeah, I can go up a lot on that, but I
yeah. Jade. And let's not get too far onto like rebirth, because I want to get back to the
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Cool. I guess, is emptiness less like thinking of it as like a destination of understanding? Like, yes, I've got it. I understand it. Like, I don't know, understanding. I was going to draw an example of understanding any given thing, but I guess, is it more of a journey? I guess understanding other things is like that too. Say understanding cooking, you can't be like, yes, I have it. I have the whole shape of it in my head. I don't know. Is it more like that? Like, well, a direction to head in?
It is and it isn't. I mean, our wisdom, our awareness of reality, which is infinite, can always be deepened. But it is a little bit, and actually this is mentioned later on in this. It's like you see a magician conjure up big crowd of people, and this is actually like, and then he cuts all their heads off, but you have seen that it is just, he just conjured them up. You do not go like right, you, once you have seen through an illusion, you never see it the same way again. So I mean, we can awaken to emptiness a little bit at a time, but that's one of the reasons that in Zen we use the term Kensho for recognizing the emptiness of yourself, which that's what we really care about the most, right? Recognizing our own empty nature. And it's just like, oh, And we never quite go back to believing in it the same way. I mean, we still get caught up in karma and stuff, but it is a was there a hand over here, or were you just Kenwin?
Yeah, so I mean, I think you kind of touched on where I was going to go, and I see it as more about like the emptiness that's within us. You know, like when you understand that all of the thoughts, all of the, you know, my body, all of this is temporary, and it's in a way it's not real, right? Like it's very ephemeral. It's here today, it's gone tomorrow. For me, that kind of brings me peace. And then the idea is that, in the sense that it's not empty, is I am alive right now in this time and place. I'm alive. And so, you know, I have to live, and it's part of the Bodhisattva vow. You know, you're trying to help other people understand that same thing. I used to have a terrible fear of death. In fact, what kind of spurred me away from atheism and towards trying to seek out spiritual truths was, you know, a false diagnosis that luckily ended up being, you know, is false. But and for several years, I was kind of like in this existential crisis. But this idea that, I don't know, like it's kind of strange, because like you would think the opposite would be true, but I just find that idea of emptiness kind of comforting. That idea of dissipating, I don't know how to describe it, but it's comforting to me.
And the beautiful thing is when we recognize that the inherent reality or essence or whatever it is not, we're just imagining it, we're just imputing it, and it's not necessary, right? Like, we think like, oh my God, what if that goes? If that goes, what happens? Nothing, right? It's just a complete, it's just something we're imagining. Everything is still. And I like to think of it as like, and you know, you may have heard me use these metaphors before, but like a forest is real. And let's say there's a particular, okay, there's that aspen grove, you know, that really ancient giant aspen grove. Okay, so that's a real thing. They'll say, even you can kind of draw boundaries around it even. You know, where is it? Where is the forest? Like, where's the essence of the forest? It's a real thing, but it can't be grasped or identified. It's no... You know, trees are, you know, grow and die. Something continues.
I think
why
that
can't
was,
we think of ourselves that way?
I think that was the other thing with that too, that's kind of helped me out, is like this idea of emptiness. Like when you have these negative emotions that pop into your head, when somebody really, you know, pisses me off, I try to stop and just realize for a second that it's not real. It's just something that's there at the moment, and then I can let it go. So mm-hmm. That's the other thing that kind of helps me with that.
Mm-hmm. Is there somebody else? All right. So if the Bodhisattva knows the five skandhas as like an illusion, but makes not illusion one thing and the skandhas another. If freed from the notion of multiple things, she courses in peace, that this is his practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. So I always just, when I studied this, these chapters back at Dharma Rain many years ago, maybe 20 years ago. And this is one of those lines that just sticks with me. I mean, and again, like many people are saying, like, I don't even necessarily know exactly what it means, but I'm like, makes not illusion one thing and the skandhas another. We know they are like an illusion. But if we're dreaming up illusion, dreaming up emptiness, dreaming up the skandhas, which are impermanent and not self, we can just create more problems for ourselves. We can, and essentially can kind of reject life, reject these five skandhas, because they're just empty. But the skandhas, like in the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. So it's not like the skandhas are kind of cheapened by their emptiness. Right, they should be a different way, but they're just empty. Like illusion, emptiness is a quality of things. Things are as they are. And in a sense, we might say they're an illusion or empty, simply to point to somewhere we're getting stuck. But illusion is empty as well. Those with good teachers as well as deep insight cannot be frightened on hearing the mother's deep tenets. So Prajna Paramita, the perfection of wisdom, is sometimes portrayed as a female, I don't even know that we'd say she's a bodhisattva. She's just archetypal image. So she's often portrayed as a, you know, beautiful, calm looking woman. And she's called the mother of all Buddhas. So by hearing the mother's deep tenets, but those with bad teachers who can be misled by others are ruined thereby as an unbaked pot when in contact with moisture. Yeah.
I guess I should go.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just feel like close, but maybe not close enough. This last paragraph that you read means a lot to me, and I'll just say what it means. It's amazing to me that I am following this as well as I am, if you think I'm doing well. Because I always feel like a beginner. I'm not sure how much I get it. I'll be the first to tell you that the Heart Sutra that we recite on Sundays, it has a certain meaning for me that I won't go into, but I would not call it uplifting. It does not make me happy. But what this is telling me here is that, you know, if we've got good teachers like you, we can get in this and be comfortable with all this kind of discussion that we've had. I could imagine myself on my deathbed, actually, in some of this discussion, or a loved one's side, and feeling okay with what's happening. But those with bad teachers who can be misled by others and ruined thereby, I mean, to me, that's the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That is the people. Those are my friends who are not in here. And so I have to be pretty careful
about how I talk about this. Not because they're going to think I'm crazy. I don't care about that. But because they won't find it uplifting. They won't find this peaceful. And oh, now I get it. Now I get it. They're, you know what I mean? That's what this tells me.
Well, I was kind of thinking about bad teachers, and like, I don't think really any, probably any Dharma teacher, you know.
Not even always.
Not such, you know, there have been super teachers and the whole spectrum. And I don't think any of them are, you know, causing unbaked pots to break, right? I mean, you know, subpar Dharma is still going to be helpful. But I'm thinking more like people who are going to encourage us to be, you know, angry or judgmental, or to seek refuge only in material things, or encourage us just to seek power, or, you know, divide. And so that's kind of what I'm thinking more of, like bad teachers, you know, taking us away from this kind of investigation. So I propose, so we're supposed to go on to the harmony of difference and sameness next class, but I propose that we just keep going with this, and then, I mean, I will just promise to do the harmony of difference and sameness. Like, it might have to be after my sabbatical, but we'll get around to it. I just think this is just such a beautiful, beautiful text that we can continue to delve into it. So, yeah. Any last, we have like a minute. After the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Arahata.
Hey everybody.
Hi.